Hi, Mario.
Hi, Anna. Bom dia. How are you?
Bom dia. I'm good. How are you?
Pretty great. I'm here in California. So it's a fun that fact that I'm Brazilian, but actually we're being interviewed from the US.
Yeah, excellent. So today my guest is Mario Pereira. He's the founder of PSR, a provider of stochastic optimization tools and consulting in energy with clients in more than 70 countries. He was a main advisor of two Brazilian governments on the management of the country's energy supply crisis and on the design of generation contracting auctions. Mario is an IEEE fellow and an elected member of the US National Academy of Engineering, Brazilian Academy of Science, and Brazilian Academy of Engineering. He was a professor at PUC Rio and a visiting professor at the IIT in Spain. He co-authored 300 papers and 4 books on optimization and energy and co-supervised 30 master's and doctoral theses. He also developed the stochastic dual dynamic programming algorithm and other well-known methodologies used in planning and reliability evaluation. Mario received several prizes, for example, a finalist France Edelman Award for his work on stochastic hydrothermal scheduling, the National Scientific Merit Medal for his research contributions, and the Presidential Rio Branco Medal for his work during the energy crisis. Mario, you are not only one of the most successful and influential OR figures out there, but you're also one of the greatest Brazilians I've ever met. So I'd like to warmly thank you for accepting this invitation to be a guest here today.
Well, that's very kind of you, and I'm really happy to be here to talk with you and your listeners.
Yeah, great. So you were born in the early 1950s, but from which part of Brazil?
I was born in Rio. Actually, I was born under the Sugarloaf, which meant that I never went up there until I was 18. You know, Sugarloaf was right up there.
Wow. So near Urca?
Yeah, near Urca, yeah.
Okay. I read somewhere that your parents were engineers and astronomers. I suppose this had a huge impact on you.
Yes, both my mother and my father are electrical and civil engineers, and also both were professional astronomers. My mother was the first female professional astronomer of Brazil. And so they, in addition, my father was a professor at the Federal University in rational mechanics. So let's say this type of scientific technical interests were part of the day-to-day on the household, and had a great influence on me. In particular, with my mother, every Saturday after she got older, we would have discussions about you know, the new things in NASA. So we followed for 10 years the Cassini probe on Saturn, and we watched together the Mars probes and so on. And she was really looking forward to see the launching of the James Webb telescope because it had been delayed for 10 years, but she knew every detail. And unfortunately, she passed away a few months before, but it was the launch was on Christmas. So all of my family got together and we watched the launch and remembered her very much. So physics, astronomy, and engineering have been a big part of my life.
Wow. Is it true that you helped your mom to make some calculations in her work, and also you helped your dad to mark exams and things like that?
Not exactly like this. In case of my dad, on the weekends he would correct the exams, and so there was a tradition in my house that when you reach a certain age, you were allowed to help him grade. That is, he would correct the questions and then you add up. And it was always a joke in my family that my sisters were soft-hearted, says, "Oh, Dad, this, you know, a low grade," and I was the hard one to say, "No, this guy's stupid. He deserves a low grade." But some years later, I was possibly 13, 14. I actually read the text of the questions because it was mechanics, you know, pulleys and this kind of thing. And I understood, and I asked my dad if the solution was like this, and he was really very happy. In the case of my mom, she would take us to the observatory, you know, as kids, and it was amazing. They open the dome and this type of thing. But She worked in the at the time in the hour service. So observatories from all over the world would get measures of the stars and send to Greenwich. And but she had to do about 5 hours of calculation every night. And she got this printed, the perforated paper tape, okay, which for us was a prize because it was really cool after she used for calculations. And one of the fun things is that we are seven brothers and sisters. So my mom would work at the very last day before giving birth. So sometimes she would take calculations to the hospital, which mystified the nurses what she's actually doing.
Wow.
So it's a very all of them are very fond memories of this environment.
Yeah. So that's where you got all your work ethic then.
Now, the work ethic had to do, I think, with the fact that my father was extremely poor. He was from another state, and he went to Rio. He got the only scholarship of the state. And my mother also came from a family that had very limited means. And so all the time, the message was that the only thing that you can really be sure that you have is your knowledge, your you know, what to achieve, because you know, money comes, money goes, you may get sick and this kind of thing. And also myself and some of my brothers and sisters were very good students, and in my house the message was, okay, being smart is the same thing as being pretty. You're born with it. You shouldn't be vain about it, okay? It's what you do with what you get is what is worth it. So that was something very important for my life and for all my brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, when you have parents that had poor conditions and they grow in life, they're able to find good jobs despite their circumstances, that's always inspiring, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah. But both my mom and my dad were my heroes in that sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I can totally relate to that. So in addition to science, do you have interest in other things?
Yeah, music. I'm a huge fan of music and all types. Right now, mostly jazz, okay? But in classical music, it was really funny because I kind of started backwards. I started with electronic music, Stockhausen, and then Varese and dodecaphonic, and went back in time. I'm let's say what I really like is Baroque music, Bach, and a little bit of Beethoven, especially the last quartets. But also, as we had talked before, from the beginning, I was very fond of Indian music. Ravi Shankar was my idol, and it was really funny because I would play, you know, Ravi Shankar records all the time. And one day was my birthday, 16. I was, I think, 16 years old. My brothers and sisters and my dad, they purchased me a tape recorder and headphones. And my joke was that now I can listen with headphones that we don't have to listen to Ravi Shankar. But to this day, you know, this is a part of music that's very much into me. And so music, mathematics, science in general, and also I'm very fond of literature. And as we had talked before, I think that when you're young, literature teaches you about life because it's kind of simulations of stories. We are people, we are beings that like stories, and you have not experienced, you know, complicated things and, you know, dramas and the illness and this kind of thing. And literature helps you a lot with that. And so I read a lot in many areas and many, many things. And one funny thing is that very generous of my father and mother, they would give me, they say, okay, you can purchase anything in terms of books. So I'm kind of self-taught and exploring, read very strange things, but this is part of the fun.
So you like more fiction or non-fiction books?
I think that when I was younger, it was more fiction, because as I said, fiction teaches you about life, about things you have not experienced. Mm-hmm. As I get older and you kind of live some of these things, both good and bad, today I tend to like more nonfiction stuff. Okay. And of course, science fiction is something that you get the bug as a teenager and you get it forever. So it's...
Yeah. You were mentioning about Ravi Shankar. You actually met him.
Yes, that was a fun story because, as I mentioned, none of my brothers and sisters really liked him, but they went to São Paulo and actually, and I stayed in Rio, and actually they met him at the hotel. And I was really frustrated, so I'm the only fan here. And my younger brother, he was 10 years old, and he said, "Mario, don't worry, Ravi Shankar is coming to Rio. He's a good friend of mine, okay, and I'll introduce you to him." I couldn't believe my 10-year-old brother. But actually, you know, in despair, we went to the hotel. He actually called the room, and we were there. So Ravi Shankar's wife was, you know, all over my little brother and this kind of thing. And I sat with him. It was very thrilling, something that I'll remember forever.
Yeah. And that was before his concert to Bangladesh.
Yes. Yes. A little bit before.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He had a series of concerts in Rio, in São Paulo, Rio. Mm-hmm. And very nice. It's a music that today still inspires me.
Wow. I'm telling this because he became famous, at least to the Western world, after that event that George Harrison organized. And I mean, the fact that you knew him before and without internet and things like that, it's very, very impressive.
No, it is part of this, what I mentioned, that you kind of look for things. In Brazil at that time, LPs were imported and extremely expensive. So my allowance would be only for, let's say, 3 LPs. Mm-hmm. And there was this store that would tell us that they had smuggled LPs. We would go at night and choose. And you didn't have reference. So you would get one record, this one. I remember that the first Led Zeppelin records I got by Pure. It just looks like a nice cover. And that's how I found Ravi Shankar as well.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. It seems that you were a big fan of Richard Feynman. How did he influence you?
Yeah, Feynman was a fantastic story. That's another of my idols. When I was in high school, I had a fantastic high school teacher, and he saw that I was interested in physics. So he gave me as a gift the Feynman books, the famous red books from his course at Caltech, and I read them like crazy. So when I got to the university, I had already the mechanics, the volume 1, electromagnetism volume 2, and quantum mechanics volume 3. And I went to university. I wanted to do physics, and I did the first 2 years in physics, and then I had a choice, and this was, you know, early 70s, so it was before the standard model. People are confused. Every week there would be a new particle. And I spoke with the physics professors at the university, which were amazing people. And they told me that, well, here we are kind of following what's being done and complementing, but let's say the real action is in the US. So I decided to go and visit several universities to feel if I wanted to have a career in physics in the US. And one of the places I visited was Caltech, where Feynman taught. And at Caltech, my uncle was a PhD student there in chemistry. My uncle today is the director of the chemistry department at the Federal University of Rio. And it was my birthday. So my uncle just told me, "Mario, go come here, and I have to finish a few things, and afterwards we'll go for pizza and wait in this room here." And I'm sitting there, and more students start to come in and say, "What's that?" And then Feynman came in. It was a surprise that my uncle had prepared for me. By coincidence, was Feynman was teaching, and I was thrilled because it was elementary, initial quantum mechanics, so I could understand. And I was even more thrilled that after the class, Feynman came to me and says, "Are you Mario?" I couldn't even speak, and says, "Well, Marco, that's my uncle, told me that it was a birthday, so he gave me a book and with a dedication in Portuguese because Feynman spent a couple of years in Brazil." So it's one of those privileges to meet somebody that has been your idol the whole time and inspiration. And Feynman has always been a reference to me. I read all of his, biography books and so on. And it's the other privilege that I had was meeting George Dancing, the father of Linear Programming. Yeah,
that's, yeah, we're going to get to back that later.
Yeah.
Wow, and meeting Feynman should have been, you know, as you said, a remarkable experience for sure. But then you came back to Brazil and then you decided to switch degrees.
Yeah, I decided that I didn't want to move to the United States. I went back to Brazil, and at that time, the government was making huge investments in the energy area. So they were creating the National Laboratories for Electricity, what's called CEPEL, a National Laboratory for Oil, what's called SEMPIS, and they were located at the campus of the Federal University. So I thought that engineering would be interesting because in addition, there were all the new developments on computer science. So I moved to the what at the time was called systems engineering. It was a very modern course for the time at the Catholic University. So you learn a little bit of electronics, a little bit of power, a little bit of telecommunications, a lot of mathematics, statistics, operations research, and computer science. So at the time we joked that when I'm kind of optimistic, just, I know a lot about I know a little about lots of things. When you're realistic, since I don't know anything about anything. But it turned out that it was a very interesting course, and I was very much interested in computer science. So we learned programming. It was funny because at the time I learned a very modern language. It was PL1. PL1 was a completely insane language that IBM had developed, which had objects, which had classes, and so on. So my first programming language was one of the most sophisticated, and I worked at as an undergraduate at a project for designing the first Brazilian mini computer, was G10. G for Guaranis, which was an admiral, was very instrumental in promoting these things. 10, because we don't want to tell people that it was just the first one. And I developed the link editor and did other things. It was a very, I think, good education. And on the other side, we had courses on operations research. And one of these courses was taught by an engineer from Eletrobras. And he was the first that introduced me to stochastic optimization and this type of thing. And there was a funny story because he gave us homework to find the optimal strategy for hydrothermal scheduling, okay? Mm-hmm. And what I'm talking, you know, late 1975 or something like this.
That's very, very ahead of the time, maybe, you know?
Yeah, and it was really funny because, you know, we studied and we thought and we discussed and said, I don't really know. We devised some approximate methods. So in the end, I went to him and said, okay, that's the best we could do. Can you tell us how to do it? And he laughs and says, nobody knows how to do it. I just thought that you guys looked smart. So, you know, who knows? And afterwards, it was funny because afterwards, when I met Danzig, he told, of course, take into account the huge differences in scale, that he had the same story. He was, he always slept late, so he got to the class and class was finished. He saw five problems. He thought they were homework, and it turned out that they were unsolved problems, and that was his PhD thesis. So I always joke with people that not knowing that something is impossible, it helps you sometimes solve it because you're not terrified.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And this professor then told me about CEPEL, the Electric Energy Research Center, and I interviewed there, and that was my first job, in addition, of course, to the work at the undergraduates for the mini computer.
Mm-hmm. As you said, you were talking about the 1970s, and I wonder how hard it was for one to code an optimization algorithm back then.
Well, we had the programming languages, we programmed all the algorithms, and I think that's very important parts because, of course, there are fantastic commercial packages, but in my opinion, you always have to know what's under the hoods. So we programmed in that PL1 language, or we programmed in Fortran. And this was the good old times of punch cards. And so everybody learned how to manage the punch cards. I remember one time that the university was upset with the students because people were stealing the typewriter tapes. So they removed from the keyboards, but we just learned how to read the holes. If you're a student, you do anything. So you programmed, you sent to the mainframe, you wait a little bit, you got the outputs, and you thought about it. So I programmed a lot of these algorithms. And later on, I wrote a book with Nelson Maculan, mm-hmm. Which was one of my heroes and my supervisor for both master's and PhD. And in the book, there was the actual code for primal simplex and dual simplex and that thing. We're very mm-hmm. proud of this little book mm-hmm. that he and I wrote together, when I was 20-something years old. That's nice.
Yeah, I had a chance to talk to Nelson Maculan here. He was a guest, and you're talking about heroes, but you yourself were the hero back then, because the lack of information, and there was no internet, and learning to do and to code all those complicated things was not easy at all.
So, yeah, but on the other hand, if you're given the opportunity and you have the right environment, people can do amazing stuff, as you know. So mm-hmm. I'm thankful that had the chance to go to a good university and to explore these things, mm-hmm. and they defined my career later on.
Yeah, and what did you do at CPL?
CPL was an interesting place. CPL was composed of two laboratories. One laboratory, high voltage laboratory, where they tested the transformers and kind of thing. It was located 20 kilometers from the lab that I worked, which was the systems laboratory. We loved the other laboratory because they blew up stuff. Okay, so when it was lunchtime, we'd go there and see. Because stress testing transformers, you actually blow them up, and young people, they love this kind of thing. Yeah. But our laboratory was more a systems laboratory, so we had some chemistry labs. I worked in the modeling area, and there were very few people when I started. And actually, when my first day at the CPL, there was nobody because all my team was being trained abroad. And so the people there did not know what to do with me. So they sent me to Eletrobras. Eletrobras at the time was the holding company for electricity in Brazil. And Eletrobras did all the planning and operations and so on. So they sent me to Eletrobras, and was a fantastic experience on the one hand. But on the other hand, you are the new guy. So I knew that they're going to give me the boring tasks. So I decided to prevent this by suggesting that I would write graphical interfaces for their models, and they love that. And as I was doing this, I became friends with another engineer, Roger Trinkenreich, who later on became the head of planning in Brazil. And we started talking about hydroscheduling, this type of thing. And we decided to write a new model for optimizing the production of the hydro plants in Brazil. Brazil, as I think many of your listeners know, is massively hydroelectric. At the time, almost all of the energy production in Brazil came from hydroelectric plants. And so we wrote a linear programming model that represents in detail the operation of the hydro plant cascades and so on, and some constraints that we kind of made up. And then something really funny happens. At the time, Brazil was building Itaipu. Itaipu was the largest plant in the world with 12,000 megawatts. And Itaipu is on the border of Argentina, and Argentina is downstream. So the Argentinians, shortly before they would actually start the construction, started complaining that they did not want Itaipu to modulate the power production. That is, they could not increase the power from, 4,000 megawatts to 5,000 megawatts very quickly, because this would change the outflow and could lead to erosion. And this type of constraint that the Argentinians wanted to impose had a huge effect, could have a huge effect on the total installed capacity of Itaipu. And Eletrobras was in a dilemma because they did not have the tools to calculate what was the impact. And by pure dumb luck, our little model could do it. So they grabbed the model and they ran the studies to decide the installed capacity of Itaipu. Jorge and I were, on the one hand, ecstatic, and the other hand, terrified. I had nightmares. Imagine there's a bug and these guys are going to make investments that are wrong, but it turned out that that's okay. And we used the Itaipu case studies as part of our master's dissertations, which was probably one of the most non-academic examples, a really megalomaniac example. And another funny story is that George was an electrical engineer, but with not real a lot of experience in real world. And I was this kind of mismatch of different disciplines. So we did all the mathematical modeling, but we had never seen an actual hydro plant. So a few weeks later, the head of the department is going by, and he saw me asking George, what does the water in the hydro plants actually goes through? And George said, I don't really. I think it falls from the top, and there's some little wheels that turn. And the head of the department was horrified. Said, imagine that if somebody hears you guys that actually contribute to deciding what is the installed capacity of Itaipu. And so he put us in a plane, and we went to see an actual hydro plant. This is amazing. And I can remember maybe it's several months later, I actually went to Itaipu and was being under construction. So we got into a little elevator from the outside of the plant. And I remember looking, it says after 5 minutes of going up in the elevator, it says, that's the part that I said was a constant. And I said, this is really, if I knew that the plant was that huge, I probably would never have the courage to make the approximations I did. So that's another example that ignorance is bliss.
Absolutely. Wow. Fantastic story. I mean, the both of them, fantastic stories. I just can wonder, how did you feel back then, you know, just planning and developing models for important decisions. And then when you visit the place, you get to see what you assumed as a constant. And it's really overwhelming.
No, but it's interesting because at that time, you're really excited with the techniques and mathematics and developing new methods. So you are so much involved with day-to-day development techniques that you don't really think of what's the impact that this has. And when you visit, you say, wow. But one thing that's funny about working with planning is that there was a time in which I wasn't sure if the things actually existed or not, because you're working day and night with these plants, you know them in detail. And once in a while, I would open the newspaper and say, so the plant so-and-so was inaugurated. Well, wasn't the plant ready yet? And so only later that you kind of, I started working more, let's say, countrywide studies in different countries that say, okay, now I know what exists and what's still being planned.
Right.
But I think that later on, when I started working with governments and helping with policy, is that you get another dimension. As I said, I think that during my career, there was a time in which, to me, the mathematical techniques were everything. Then when I started helping the governments, I learned a lot about institutions and how important it is to have, a correct legal and regulatory framework. Later on, when I started working with energy policies and renewable integration and decarbonization, you get the political dimension. Mm-hmm. And there was a funny story on that, because I used to go a lot to the World Bank. And so I went there, they made presentations full of equations. But there was a time in which we're going to talk a bit later, in which I helped manage the ration in Brazil. So I spent 2 years managing the ration in Brazil. And then I went back to the World Bank, and people said, hey, what happened with the other Mario? Because the other times you just fill the blackboard with equations. Now you have these boxes and arrows about institutional organization, and said, yeah, you grow up. I think that I still believe that science and mathematics and quantitative analysis is the core of rationality. But you learn that you need to know a lot of things, and there are a lot of other dimensions that are necessary for things to become reality, or at least for things to be done in a good way that will benefit society. Mm-hmm. So that was also a great learning.
Yeah. So at some point, you got a job offer from the Electric Power Institute in California, and it seems that you became their first foreign employee.
Yeah, oh, that was also a funny story. I had been with the CPL for some years. I had developed some new methods. I had published and been to IEEE meetings and so on. And one day, my boss at CPL said, Mario, there is these people from Electric Power Research Institutes, and one of them works in this planning area that worked. My boss was a nuclear engineer, Jerzy Lepecki. So he supported us, but he was not really an expert in the area that we worked. And so I said, would like to talk with him. He says, yeah, I had no idea whatsoever what EPRI was. So this guy comes, very nice. And he says, well, you worked in expansion planning. I said, yeah, what do you think of this model? And I said, this is a horrible model. This is models. Doesn't work. And what this other model? And I said, this is even worse. And what about this other model? This doesn't. And he laughed and said, do you realize that I'm the one that financed all of this? I was really, really embarrassed. Okay. He says, oh, I'm sorry. It's a, and the guy said, no, this is music for my ears, because I have the money to finance all this, everybody tells me that these models are the greatest thing in the world. And you were one of few, very few people that told me what they really like. And so we talked more about other things. At the end of the day, thank you very much, bye-bye. And I forgot about EPRI. And then a few months later, I got an offer from a huge construction company in Brazil. And the guys would quadruple my salary. And I really didn't want to work with them, so I started making up excuses. Well, I really like academic work. Well, you can have as much time for academic work as you wish. I like to go to congresses. You have money to go to Congress. So it starts scratching my head. I need to find an excuse. I went to talk to my boss at CPL. My boss said, well, we realize that we cannot match the financial office. No, I know. But he asked, is there something that you like? And I said, well, since I did my master's in Brazil, I would like an opportunity to spend some time abroad. And he said, what about these guys that you met from EPRI? Would like to go there? And I said, oh, that's interesting. And then he said, I'm going to call them and we'll find a way to fund your trip there. Next day, he came back laughing and says, Mario, I called them and says, oh, is this crazy guy that told us that nothing that we do work? And I say yes. He says, no need for a CPL to finance. We'll hire him. So I got a leave of absence from CPL, and I was hired, and I was EPRI's first foreign employee. And then I realized that I had been very lucky, because EPRI was the core of Silicon Valley. The building at our side was the famous Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. So that the guys who invented Ethernet and interface during lunch would go out there just to see the new stuff. And EPRI itself was a very unique institution. They did not do research. They financed research. They were sponsored by the utilities. Let's say in today's money, their budget would be $1 billion per year for research. And there were just 80 people, 80 of us, project managers. And you get there, and they got this manual for the EPRI manager. And the first page is, congratulations. Your EPRI, it means that you're an outstanding researcher. And then you turn the page, this stops now. You're not here to do research. You're here to manage research. And the first lesson is, you're not competing with the guys that you're contracting. You're helping them do research. And I was fascinated by this. And the thing that I love most is that they said, well, you're going to be working in very different areas, like low temperature superconductors and all kinds of advanced stuff. And we don't expect you to be an expert in these areas, but you have a limited budget to hire consultants to teach you about this. So here I am, I found Disneyland, so I could get any EPRI report. And my boss said that at EPRI, he said that the funniest thing was that they showed me to my office, and of course the office was empty. And he said, oh, here's this and this, and says, here you can call the library and you can order any EPRI report. And at the time, Brazil had a lot of problems with foreign currency. So the library at CEPEL, it was complicated to get even one single EPRI report. And my boss at the time said, Mario, your eyes started brightening. So next day, my office was from bottom to with piles of EPRI reports. I spent 2 weeks reading all of the EPRI reports in the area. So I went to him and says, you do realize that you have three projects with different names doing exactly the same thing. Really? So, and it was a great experience because I never intended to stay there. So I started being a kind of, in addition to doing my own job, my own tasks, I started helping the other guys as a kind of technical consultant. Because so I got along very well with everybody. In the beginning, they were kind of suspicious because it looked like the auditor coming, okay? Mm-hmm. But it turns out that they realized that, first of all, I didn't want to stay there in the US. I just wanted to be for a while. And I was really interested in helping them. So they became a lifelong friends. Mm-hmm. It was a very special time. And in parallel, that was the funny story with Danzig, because Joe Danzig was my hero. I realized that EPRI was very close to the Stanford University. So out of a hunch, I said, can I have 10% of my time to work with Stanford? I had no contact with Stanford, but I said, and the guy said, okay. So we got set up, and I told my wife that I'm going to call George Danzig, and maybe he'll receive me for 15 minutes.
So wow, just like yeah. that?
Yeah, but it was really funny. So I called the secretary, and she said, no, you can have a half an hour. And it was, I think, 3 p.m. or 4 p.m. or something like this. And I told my wife, you know, we're going to talk. I'm going to talk with him for half an hour. And it was the first time we went to the Stanford campus. I said, go around, visit Stanford campus and so on. But George was amazing. And he and I got really, hit it off. And 3.5 hours later, we realized that it says, oh, my God. I told my wife to wait for me, after half an hour. And George left and said, you're in trouble because they closed the doors of the operations research department at 4:30. So she's outside and she's been waiting for you for 2 hours. And he left and says, don't worry, I'll help you. So we went there, introduced himself to Claudia, my wife, and the usual things, oh, Brazilians, all the Brazilians are so nice and kind of thing. My wife, smiled at him and says, it's a pleasure to meet you. And of course, when he left, she said, you're not going to get away with this. But it turned out that afterwards, we started having, great relationship. George was very much interested in energy. He had developed the pilot model many years ago. And in a way, it was funny because I joked with him that he had the heart of a central planner. See, he had the heart of a Soviet planner. He really wanted to have central dispatch with the economy. He says, you're wrong. You're born in the wrong part of the world. And he was very much interested in the models and so on. And in particular, we shared a love of decomposition. And it was really funny because I loved Danzig Wolf decomposition, but from the numerical point of view, it was horrible.
Yeah.
Whereas Bender's decomposition worked well. And Droid had a problem because he hated the fact that Bender's composition worked, and he couldn't even say the name. He referred to Bender's composition as the duo of Dancing Wolf.
Really?
So,
Wow.
Yeah. So one of my achievements was to say, to convince George that he could accept Bender's composition. And after a while, he did work with Bender's, with Gerd Infringer and Bob Antrenkin, and was nice. I joke with people, say that my greatest achievement was to convince George that Bender's a composition. It was a wonderful time. He was a fantastic person. I will always be grateful for the time we had together. And there were lots of, first of all, he introduced me to people that were amazing, like Donald Knuth, mm-hmm. the guy who wrote the Art of Computer Programming. Knuth's books are the equivalent of Feynman Red books, you know, if you were really into computer programming. Mm-hmm. And so he introduced me to Don Knuth. One day we were just walking, and there was this older gentleman that came, and he introduced me with Packard from HP, Hewlett Packard. I got to know Fulkerson and all of those guys. So it was an amazing time. And there was also a very funny story. He invited Claudio and I to the birthday party. And there were a lot of Nobel Prizes, like Kenneth Arrow. And there was Linus Pauling. And so the first thing is that Linus Pauling had a cold. So everybody was teasing him because Linus Pauling is the vitamin C type of thing. And my wife stepped on the foot of Kenneth Arrow. said, you know what you have done? And she said, I don't care about your nerdy friends. Wonderful time.
So I mean, to process all that, you know, amount of information and experience should have been fantastic, you know?
I agree with you. Again, I was very lucky because at CPL, I learned to do applied research. And because we were at the campus of the university, we had a great interaction with the academics, especially through Nelson Maculin. And at EPRI, I learned to manage research, and I also was exposed to the whole environment of the tech hubs. From that point on, I went to Palo Alto for work in different areas almost every year. So, for example, at the corner of our house, that's where the Google offices were created on the two blocks. That's where Steve Jobs lived. And for example, there was a book, a recent book on PayPal. It was really interesting for us because they say, well, Elon Musk had met with these guys at Cafe Verona. That's the place that you would go, and there would be all of these. So Palo Alto, as you know, it's funny because although it's the hub of the tech world, it looks like a 1950s town. There's no evidence whatsoever that it is a tech place. So I enjoyed, and I saw, for example, when the first Tesla shop with their Roadster was open. And so it was something that became part of my education. Mm-hmm. And it always created incentive for my interest in new technologies and this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. So many things were happening in your life during the 70s and 80s, including your PhD that started in 1977.
You really want to talk about it.
Yeah, and you graduated in 1985.
Yeah, the PhD story was kind of, it's embarrassing. But what happened was that I finished undergraduate in 4.5 years. So I immediately started taking the master's courses. And 3 months later, I had my master's dissertation. It was really quick. And as I told you, I was at CPL. I was very much involved in the academic activities. So I started really collaborating with the professors and helping with courses. And they allowed me to supervise master students and even some PhD students. I would get a special dispensation, kind of special permission to do this, although I did not have a PhD. And then you get lazy because life is good, you're having fun. And so I started, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with my PhD, was to combine optimization theory to network properties. And so I started kind of dragging on and on and on. And time was passed, and I was having fun, and I was supervising, was writing papers and so on. So one day I had what I call very, very friendly intervention. Nelson Maculan, Clóvis Gonzaga, and Marinho called and said, Mario, this is ridiculous, okay? Either you finish the PhD thesis or we'll give you an honorary PhD, but it's really embarrassing for us to have you as a student. And I apologized to them, I said that they're absolutely right. So I wrote very quickly my doctor thesis and became legalized.
Was it during your PhD that you devised your famous stochastic dual dynamic programming algorithm, or that came afterwards?
No, it came afterwards. As I mentioned, I've always been interested in the hydro scheduling problem. And while I was at CEPEL, I started having the first inklings, okay? I remember that we called them at the time the messengers. I said, somehow, I'm here today, I'm going to send messages to the future to see the effect of this decision. The messages will send back information. And so little by little, started having kind of this thing started to make sense, but did not have the grasp on how the algorithm would work. And then this is a true story. It is a really funny story. At the time, Brazil had, as I mentioned, a lot of constraints on currency. Okay, in particular, if you are not allowed to purchase dollars for a trip as a tourist, you had to pay a huge amount of money. And if you're traveling to work, you had a special permission to buy the money for the academic trip or work trip. But they would require you to have a different passport, official business passport. So you have your green passport with your US visa, but they would issue blue passports. With a blue passport, you would get the money. And then, of course, the blue passport was useless because you don't have a visa. You throw away the blue passport and traveled with the green passport. And next time, you ask for another blue passport and so on. But I was going to in two travels sequentially, and I said, this is a waste, okay? Let me ask for a blue passport that would actually cover the two trips. So I got the blue passport, I purchased the money, I put the blue passport in my pockets, I used the green passport to travel. And then maybe a month later, I went back to the bank and said, okay, I want to purchase more money for the second trip. And the guy said, but there is no evidence that you took the first trip. And I said, oh, okay, sure. And so I started getting my green passport. And the guy said, I know what you're going to do. You're going to show me that you have the exit stamp on the green passport, because the green passport is the only one that has the visa, okay? And this passport is useless. I said, yes, yes. It says, yes, I know this, you know this, but the government says that it's illegal. So you're actually in a fraudulent situation because you want to purchase more dollars and you don't have official evidence. The only official evidence is the stamp and the blue passport. So they arrested me. So
really?
I was arrested. Of course, the guys were very polite. I said, so we're going to keep you here, okay? And that was the federal police, uh-huh. Okay? And they said, we're going to get in contact with the research center to clarify the situation. So I was stuck for 3 hours in a room, okay? And fortunately, I had pencil and paper, and I started, so I had nothing to do. I started thinking about the algorithm. That's where the SDDP was born.
And, no kidding.
The SDDP for many years at CEPEL was nicknamed the Federal Police Algorithm. I was bored. I said, okay. So the guys came, and so of course they were very nice and said, okay, the situation has been regularized. They issued another passport, pretend the other passport never existed. And I purchased the dollars and went. But the benefits of crazy Brazilian regulations that they forced me to be by myself for 3 hours, and that's where
you really know how to get the best out of each situation, and you should get arrested more times. So
no,
more ideas come. That's incredible, Mario. Lovely to hear that.
It was the what is called the federal police algorithm.
Wow. But then why did you decide to leave CEPEL after returning to Brazil? And what did you do when you became unemployed?
Yeah, two things. I came back to Brazil. I had to interrupt my time at EPRI and Stanford because my dad got really sick and he passed away a few weeks after I came back. And so I went back to CEPEL and I started some activities there. And one of the activities was to develop a new planning model for Bonneville Power Administration. We had been working on distributed processing. This was old times. And we actually sold a new way to work with distributed processing for Bonneville Power Administration. So I was at Bonneville, and they asked me, I say, can this device that you have solve the problem of VAR planning, that is to plan the capacitors? And I said, no. And I said, but what's the problem? I says, well, we discovered that capacitors have PCB, which causes cancer. We're going to replace all the capacitors. So since we're going to replace, we want to optimize location. And I said, no, the distributed process is not going to help you, but my colleague at CEPEL, Sergio Granville, has developed a technique for solving optimal power flow problems using nonlinear interior point methods, interior point methods, and we have seen how we can combine this with decomposition. So we think we have a mathematical technique for solving the problems. And like I said, we're going to have international bids for doing this. And if you're interested in doing this bid, they say, yeah, sure. So I went back. We wrote overnight the proposal. My boss at CEPEL signed it. And we're very proud because our competitors are Electricia France, Ontario Hydro, and so on. And we won was the very first foreign work that CEPEL had done. And it went very well. But this was old times. You would communicate with people with fax and so on. And one of the people at BPA, he had the guy who was the project manager, he had lots of doubts and we're seeing we're not communicating well with him. So I said, it's easier. I go there and I, explain to him. So I said, tickets plus a total $2,000. I went to my boss and said, I need $2,000 to go there. And the boss said, can I give you the money? Why not? We just received like $150,000 of one installments of the project. So there's a new law by the government that all the money has cannot be used, okay, because the government is on a saving mode. And my boss was very proactive. He tried to solve the problem. And I was shocked. I said, but it's our reputation. And so in the end, I paid for my own money. I went there, solved the problem, got an extension of the project, even more money, came back, and I told him that I cannot go on working here because I understand, you have been very supportive, but it's, to me, it's very unsettling that because of bureaucracy, our reputation can go away. So I decided to leave, and so I spent some time as a professor at the Catholic University. But also at that time, I received an invitation from EPRI, because some time had passed and the EPRI people said, would like now to compete for new projects at EPRI. And I said, okay. So we bid for a project which was to calculate the transmission reliability of the East Coast. And we won, and that was the start of PSR. Mm-hmm. And these were also kind of fun times because most of the budget was for renting mainframes, but at the time they had just released the numerical coprocessor 8387, and I said that I think that we can do this. But there was another obstacle is that Brazil had this crazy law that you could not import computer equipment because they had this hope that completely unfounded that they would develop a national semiconductor. Mm-hmm. So my mother smuggled the computer for me. It's a very distinctive mother. and very loving. And it was a board developed by MIT called Hummingboard. It was 1 megabyte of storage, amazing memory, and 387. So we developed the whole thing in that a board that you could fit into, you know, a PC. And the model became, you know, it worked well. It's amazing what you can do in a small space if you have to do this. Mm-hmm. And the model was called CREAM, Composite Reliability Assessment by Monte Carlo. I couldn't resist. I called the interface COFFEE, Command-Oriented Facilities for File Editing, and the graphic analysis, the statistical analysis, SUGAR, Statistical Test for Graphic Analysis. So it was an APRI model, CREAM, COFFEE, and SUGAR.
Yeah. Okay,
so that was our very first job, and that's the origin of PSR.
Wow, fantastic. I mean, you had a crazy life, you know, in a good sense. But it's, you know, by chance you got this and that. You got, of course, the help of your parents, being the right place at the right time. It is just incredible. But what is the secret for the great success of PSR over the years?
I think that, as I said, I never thought of being a businessman, opening a business. But essentially, you know, we did this first work, and it went well. And then word of mouth started spreading. So our second client was New Zealand. Our third client was Colombia. And little by little, I realized that there was a market for you know, advanced optimization models. And I think that I was lucky, because in the energy area, really it's one of the areas in which first quantitative analysis helps, and the problems are really complicated, so having advanced technique helps. And I think that because from the beginning we made the bet that you know, there would be a market for these advanced tools, we never compromised. So we always you know, worked as a research organization. So I was very proud that PSR had more papers, academic papers being published than you know, most many departments. And I started hiring people that would share the same ideas. First, the people that work at PSR came from CEPEL, which people I knew and liked. And also, we are a small company, so. But I had many friends from in different countries that at the time there was the energy reform, and these friends became consultants. So we established a kind of, again, in a kind of a accidental way. So I would provide these friends with advanced versions of the models, so I would leverage their business. And they would tell me about what the market was wanting. So they give me the business intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so that was a kind of a PSR's first business model. We had a network of, let's say, small companies, people that we trust. So we worked in a very formal way. And we would develop new versions of the model. We would license the versions of the model. And people like. And mm-hmm. The other thing that was kind of funny is that, for example, you see a lot in many companies, proprietary methods or kind of, and with PSR was the opposite. We would publish everything. And I would say that, I would also tell that people would ask, would bore them, because we love to talk about this or go into details. Mm-hmm. And we never realized that this gave us a lot of credibility. Because if you go to a company and the company says, oh, we can solve a problem, but we have these secret methods. And with us, we say, okay, you want to know how we do it and this kind of thing. And we realized that clients are not really interested in copying our software, duplicating results. They're interested in having the problem solved. Uh-huh. And they started to trust us a lot, because there was no secret about this. And so we started having, say, repeated clients. We have today, we have clients that have been working with. For example, as I mentioned, one of our very first clients were Colombia and New Zealand. They still work with us after 25 years. And we had a very, very high renewal of the software. Mm-hmm. and almost 100%. So, and we went on. So in a way, I think that the fact that one client once said that the fact that we did not try to sell stuff, we would work just telling people, it turned out to be a very effective selling tool, because ultimately what people want is credibility, confidence,
right,
and this type of
transparency thing, and things like that.
Yeah, transparency. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing is that you learn as you grow. So we started with, four people, then 10 people, then 40 people. Today we have 110 people. And things that we started by accident turned out to be good choices. For example, we have at PSR, I think we have 25 PhDs, 30 people with master's degrees. Almost all of them did their graduate work with us at PSR. And essentially, we have very good relationship with the professors at the university. So we go talk with the supervisors, and we always almost always find a common topic, because the real life problems are very complex. So they require advanced tools. I joke that I never seen an algorithm that I could not use. And so from the point of view academic, they turn out to be great papers and dissertations and so on.
Right.
And from the practical application, you know, you have a real life case, it's more fun than have a toy case. And I think that this creates a culture of a lot of respect and a lot of interaction with the academic community. And so, and it's a true interchange. We're incredibly grateful. We have great friends. We're proud that some of our engineers have went on to become professors at universities and this type of thing.
So you yourself, you acted as a professor at Puuk Hiu.
Both at Puuk, and then I was a visiting professor at the Instituto de Investigaciones Tecnológicas in Spain. But for example, I discovered that I have some interesting limitations, because a part of the professor's job is to teach, for example, undergraduate courses and something. And I, you know, I'm a good presenter. I like this stuff, and I'm clear about the stuff. But I discovered that I did not enjoy teaching a course about something that I did not know in depth. For example, at Puuk, I had to teach a course about computational linear algebra. And this was uncomfortable, because I said, I have not really, I don't know in depth all of these techniques, so I don't get a feel for what works and what doesn't work. Whereas when I was teaching the composition, I knew really what worked. And so that was one interesting limitation. The other thing that was, again, it's because for so many years I have kind of worked either from home, because different from the US, where startups starting garages. In the case of PSR, I started in my apartment's kitchen. And so, but all the time, you know, in my own home or little offices, we started. And so, at the university, they had all of these committee meetings and all of these bureaucracies at the university. I don't think anybody at the university actually likes those, but to me it was also something as I discovered that I was not too fond. I have tremendous respect, and but I say I discovered to my actually to my surprise that I was not purely academic life was not something that I enjoyed, but I have tremendous respect for people to enjoy. So it's kind of a PSR became a kind of a half university, half business.
Right. Can you briefly comment about your experience of working for the Brazilian government and to see your work positively affecting the life of so many people?
Yeah. What happened was that we were advisors. We were working in many countries, but also in Brazil. And starting to 1998, we started to see that there would be a supply problems in Brazil. We started telling people, and for some reason, government was denying, was in a denial state. And at the time, we had no relationship whatsoever with the government. And but at the end of beginning of 2001, I was called by Pedro Malan, who was then the Minister of Finance, and I knew him personally, and because of that, we never talked about work. And he said, Mario, I'm hearing that there's going to be, you know, some supply problems in Brazil. I was scared. You know, this is a very serious situation. You guys are not aware of that. And I told him a little bit. He was surprised. And so next day, I went to Brasilia. For you to have an idea how far I was from the government, I had not been in Brasilia for 11 years. I had not stepped. Brasilia is the capital. Uh-huh. I stepped in Brasilia for 11 years. He took me directly to the presidential palace where Pedro Parente, the chief of staff, was there. So I told, you know, Pedro Parente about the situation. They were very surprised. But it's amazing to see how these guys react. So they said, well, we have to do two things. So we have to start emergency management of the situation and also create an investigation of the cause of rationing. And of course, these are conflicting because if you're going to do the investigation, you create a problem, people get nervous. So they agreed with them that Pedro Malan would take care of the investigation and Pedro Parente would take care of the actual management. And that investigation will go very slow, so we had time to solve the problem, then worry about what happened. And they asked me if I wanted to take care of the investigation. I said that that's a little bit of conflict of interest. I suggested Gerson Kelman. He was the head of the water agency, and so he became the head of the investigation. And Pedro Parente said, and I said, okay, good luck. And Parente left and said, no, I think I'll be seeing you again. So afterwards, I was hired to help the management of the rationing. And so we spent almost 2 years. So we split PSR. There were a group of us who went to work almost full time for the government, and another started with the business. And it was very challenging because it was the most severe rationing in the Western world since the Second World War. People had suggested that through rotating blackouts, we showed that this would create a spiral because if a force a blackout, people start to use, use more, and this would spiral into 13 hours a day, which would be a chaos. And so we came with the idea that people could do this on a voluntary basis. And it was very interesting because it's just a question of trust. If you have the credibility, people will collaborate. So Pedro Parente was a genius in communication. Mm-hmm. He got his credibility. And the other thing which was interesting is that there were laws that gave Pedro Parente almost unlimited power. So we had actually the power to write laws. And so, and because, for example, I tell people that you're going to use 80% of the energy used in the past, okay? Mm-hmm. What if you just moved? What if new family is going to move? There were a lot of details. So we had to write laws for all of these details, and it was lightning methods. But I had to say, okay, what we have this problem here. Where's the suggestion? I said, well, you do this, or you do that, and do that. And he had this uncanny feeling that he would look at the room and everybody's in agreement. Okay, this is a law. Let's go for the other one. And the other one says, Mario, you don't look happy. I say, yeah, I'm not sure this is a good solution. What do you suggest? Da, da, da. Everybody happy? It's a law. And then he would look, no, you don't look happy with what Mario's suggesting. Okay, you two guys hash it out. Next meeting, you come with a solution. So he never let people waste time discussing this type of thing. And on the other hand, there were no hierarchies. So mm-hmm. It didn't matter if you were a minister or if you're just a technical person, anybody had the same weight, and this helped a lot. Mm-hmm. And wow. Also, Pedro Parente was a genius. He says that, I want to hear bad news. I want to hear the situation. No. This is a place where you don't kill the messenger. On the other hand, on the contrary, you help the messenger. So was a fantastic lesson in managing, government. I had never had any experience in government, and I had, hands-on test. Uh-huh. And there were lots of fun stuff. For example, he asked me to teach a course because there was discussion on what we should do. So I gave a course to the president of the country, to the ministers, and I sent the president actually to the blackboard to do example on hydro scheduling, and it was an amazing experience. And In the end, the rationing was very much praised. We managed to do this with minimum damage to society. That's one example I call of perverse effects. So we screw up, we create energy crisis, then we are praised for managing well the energy crisis, then we become consultants. We became consultants to manage energy crises all over the world. And I always said, this is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
But the other thing that we did was that, after the rationing was under control, we went back and say, okay, what was wrong? Okay, what caused the rationing? We showed that the rationing had no relationship with the power market reform. But we also showed that the power market reform was fragile, that if we implemented the power market reform as it was, there would be another rationing. So in 2002, what we did was to redesign the power market reform. And I was very much involved in that. And that's where the ideas for contracting through auctions and the creation of the planning agency came. But then a funny thing happened, or interesting thing happened, because the opposition won the election, presidential election in 2002. And the opposition was the Workers' Party, had a completely different idea of what to do. But Pedro Parente again said, no, that's life. So we just implemented the minimal changes that we need to keep things going, because he said, now it's the new government that has to solve the problem. And to my surprise, myself and Joaquin Levy, who later on became Minister of Finance, were invited by the Workers' Party government to go and advise them. And despite the fact that we did not, Dilma Rousseff, who was the Minister of Energy, she knew and she was very clear about this. I know that you did not vote for the Workers' Party, but I want to do technical stuff. So we started helping her, and it was a very interesting experience, because we spent 6-7 months going over in detail what has been done. And ultimately, she agreed that this was a better path than what was in the proposal of the Workers' Party. So adopted this, and that's how the auctions and so on. Because one thing, and I think she has a great merit, I'm sure she has a great merit, because one thing is to propose, the other thing is to actually implement. Mm-hmm. And the auctions themselves were kind of, again, as crazy as designing the Itaipu thing I mentioned, because Brazil had no credibility with auctions. We had no track records, and we decided to make the largest energy auctions in the world, but it turned out they were very successful, and $550 billion in contracts, yeah. No defaults and sort of thing. Yeah.
Should have been very proud about that. I remember vividly the crisis that we had to save power and things like that.
But it was a team effort, and I always tell people that everywhere in the world there's such a polarization between different parties, and this was an example of two parties which actually have very different views on how to manage the country, that did something that was amazing, that there was a continuity between mm-hmm. the proposals from one party to the implementation of the other party.
Yeah, they're rational. That's very good. One may claim that there might be a large gap between theory and practice of OR. As a very successful practitioner with an excellent scientific reputation, what's your take on this?
As I said, I think in particular in this area of energy, the problems, the real life problems, are very complex, but they are ultimately multi-stage stochastic optimization problems. So any technique that is developed in the academia, okay, possibly has a good application. I think what is necessary is for people in academia to understand that there is interesting problems outside, and people on the outside valuing the knowledge in academia. And that's, as I said, I think that I'm extremely lucky, because I had the privilege of, living within academia, living within national labs, doing applied research, and living, doing these things for actual countries and actual applications when people are spending actual money in this. And it's abundantly clear to me that the efforts of the three pieces are perfectly compatible, okay? And so in a way, that's one of the reasons I try to tell people is that you know, just look a little bit on the outside, everybody. So if you're a company, look a little bit to the academia. If you're academia, look a little bit on the outside. And because, you know, the problems are there. And as I said, almost all the problems require new knowledge and new techniques. For example, and the other thing that's very interesting is that with distributed processing and these massive amounts of computation, it changes totally the mindset. And we just finished, for example, our work for the Northwest Power Planning, the U.S. Pacific Northwest, in which their planning model requires a solution of 212 million large-scale MIPS. And they wanted to do this in 5 hours. We did it in 5 hours, but using 30,000 processes, okay? It's a massive amount of cloud computing. And the other thing is that the new tools are amazing, like Julia Jump. And so I think that, first of all, anything that's cloud-based together with these amazing new software development tools and also Spark and the databases, you know, you can do fantastic stuff. And wow. So I'm very optimistic and, I'd say, very enthusiastic about what you can do, and you can actually have impacts on people's lives. Because although we work, you know, as I said, with New Zealand and countries in Europe and Canada and the US, I'm particularly proud of how we've been able to help Nicaragua, El Salvador, small countries in Asia and this kind of thing, because that's where you see that your world has an actual impact. Those countries have extremely limited resources, so it's really fundamental that you try to do your job the best way you can.
So it might not draw much attention when you help some developing countries when compared to the rich ones, but they are actually the more challenging and maybe the most
certainly rewarding. Yeah, certainly rewarding. No doubt about that. But the other thing that I joke with people that if I want to impress a client, okay, I'll show how I manage the whole West Coast of the United States. But large systems, they have redundancies, so they're much more convex, okay? In a way, they're much easier. If you want to solve a real problem, try to operate Nicaragua, because each small plant, which is its own fibers and strange things, affects. So it's a really very complicated, non-convex integer problem. Mm-hmm. And large systems impress people, but the real ones who are proud is solve a small system. Mm-hmm. Because that's where all the horrible things that are not supposed to happen.
Yes.
And the other thing that I think it's an important difference is that when you're doing a real application, you have to have a feasible solution, okay? So for example, if you're doing dual methods, you have, it's no use to say my algorithm did not converge. My algorithm, for example, use a lot of heuristics. We always try to get a feasible solution as quickly as possible. The other thing is that there is no such thing as the optimal. There is a lot of uncertainty on the data, this type of thing. It's called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And what you really want is systematically good solutions that you don't screw up, okay? Mm-hmm. And the third thing is that you have to do it in the time allotted. If you're doing the scheduling of a country for the next day, your algorithm cannot last 4 days. Mm-hmm. You have to have the and so these are things are part of the the makeup of the real tools. Mm-hmm. And for example, there was Department of Energy, ARPA had a contest of the fastest optimal power flow, and we're discussing with the people that actually have the power flows for the most control centers in the world. And we're saying that most of the actual software they use is, for example, handles with strange situations, okay? things are not feasible, things, and when you're in these competitions, people don't really care about this.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's something that I think that academic people realize and learn very quickly. So it's not an obstacle at all.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the current opportunities and trends when it comes to applying OR in the energy sector.
I think the energy sector is the perfect place because, again, has a real life impact. Energy is affecting everything and it has an underlying rationality. Despite political pressure. So ultimately, you know, you're talking about you want to have a system that is economic, is reliable, is flexible, and now resilience. And you can formulate this with the tools. So there's tremendous amount of opportunities, and also it's an area in which there is a lot of matching, overlapping with distributed processing, you know, like digital twins and something. It's data intensive, okay, but it has rationality. So I joke with people that if you look 30 years back and say, Mari, you were a visionary because you worked in energy and these tech things. It's pure dumb luck, but today looks good because it's a combination of the two things.
Yeah.
And there's tremendous opportunities.
Yeah, now you can profit from the decisions you took 30 years ago. And
or
say,
at least I can brag. Yeah, at least I can brag.
Yeah. Nice.
About this. But I know it's pure dumb luck, but it looks good in retrospect.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it's even more for the future. I think that energy is one of the areas, again, in the world that's polarized and this kind of thing, one of the areas in which there's a lot of space for rationality, for data-driven decisions, and for massive computing and advanced optimization. I think it's really, I would encourage young people everywhere to look at this area, mm-hmm. because you're going to be helping the world, doing fun stuff, and making sure that you're working in an area that still rationality prevails.
Mm-hmm. Mario, you are a very knowledgeable and a thorough thinker. And you just mentioned about young people. So what message would you like to give to the young generation of scientists, researchers, optimizers, and so on?
I think the main message is that although we are living in dark days, okay, this has happened before. I think that when you get older, you tend to think that you're getting more impatient, but then you realize the world's like this, okay? You advance 3 steps, you go back 2 steps, you go sideways 5 steps. And I've lived through hyperinflation, I lived under military regimes, I lived under complicated situation. I'm not minimizing what's happening right now, but I think the message is that the bad things go away. Okay, and what never goes away is the ability to contribute a little bit, a little brick to the beauty of knowledge. Okay, and there's amazing things that people can do, especially in the era of energy decarbonization and everything. So I would encourage everybody to go there. There's amazing amount of tools, computational power, and you can do a lot of good. And having fun in the process, I would encourage people to really go into science and technology, mm-hmm. and especially optimization. Nothing can beat optimization.
Right. So to conclude, what are your plans for the future?
Well, I am. I changed a couple of years ago. I'm a chief innovation officer at PSR, which means that head of the playgrounds. I deal with kids. And so I'm working, for example, in quantum optimization, things related to quantum annealing. And basically we developed, for example, a way to transform all the optimization problems, integer, into cubo formats. And the nice thing is that quantum computers, they like products of integer variables. So it's a different, completely different mindset. For decades, we've been trained into formulating the problems as mixed linear, okay, integer programming. Now, yeah, we can reformulate the problems into cubo formats with the products, and we're getting very interesting results in planning. So that's one of the areas. So we're doing a lot of work also on combination of reinforcement learning with optimization. basically physics-based machine learning. And I think that these are two areas in the future. So I still manage a PSR, but I say I'm doing a lot of the work on innovation. And that's another thing that I have to do. What a privilege is that I'm dealing with lots of kids. The median age of PSR, we have 110 people, is 28 years old. So half the people are younger than 28. So I've been having lots of fun with the Gen Z and all of these kids. It's fantastic and makes you young. As that's, I think, one thing from the academic areas. It's students and makes you young. And final words is one thing I tell people, that you're only young once, but you can be immature forever.
That's
and that's my motto.
Yeah, great message. I couldn't agree with you more. So Mario, it was an honor to have this conversation with you. I'm very grateful for your precious time. It was very, very inspiring. I had a lot of fun. Muito obrigado.
No, it was a real pleasure. Eu que agradeço. Muito obrigado.
So if you're coming to João Pessoa one of these days, don't forget to visit us at WebPB.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
See you soon.
See you.
Ciao, Mario.
Bye-bye. Ciao.